you or give you anything she'd written?
No,
she said. She crammed fries into her mouth and then said,
I ain't seen nothing like that. Why, what was it?
I don't know.
Maybe it were a shopping list or something.
Yeah, that's what the police thought. You're sure you didn't notice her carrying a bit of paper? A letter? An envelope?
Yeah, I'm sure. Kieran know you're meeting me?
Asked Rochelle. Yeah, I told him you were on my list. He told me you used to live at St. Elmo's. This seemed to please her. Where are you living now?
What's it to you?
She demanded, suddenly fierce. It's nothing to me, I'm just making polite conversation. This drew a small snort from Rochelle.
I got my own place in Hammersmith now.
She chewed for a while, and then, for the first time, proffered unsolicited information.
We used to listen to D.B. Mack in his car, me, Kieran and Lula.
And she began to rap.
No, hydroquinone, black to the backbone, taking D.B. lightly, better buy an early tombstone. I'm driving my Ferrari, fuck Johari, got my head on straight. Nothing talks like money talks, I'm shouting at ya, Mr. Jake.
She looked proud, as though she had put him firmly in his place, with no retort possible.
That's from hydroquinone, she said. On Jake on my jack.
What's hydroquinone? Strike asked.
Skin lightener. We used to wrap that with the car windows down, said Rochelle.
A warm, reminiscent smile lit her face out of plainness. Lula was looking forward to meeting D.B. Mack then, was she?
Yes, she was, said Rochelle. She knew he liked her. She was pleased with herself about that. Kieran was proper excited and all. He kept asking Lula to introduce him. He wanted to meet D.B.
Her smile faded. She picked morosely at her burger, then said,
Is that all you want to know, then? 'Cause I gotta go.
She began wolfing the remnants of her meal, cramming food into her mouth. Lula must have taken you to a lot of places, did she?
Yeah,
said Rochelle, her mouth full of burger. Did you go to Uzi with her?
Yeah, once.
She swallowed and began to talk about the other places she had seen during the early phase of her friendship with Lula, which, in spite of Rochelle's determined attempts to repudiate any suggestion that she had been dazzled by the lifestyle of a multimillionaireess, had all the romance of a fairy tale. Lula had snatched Rochelle away from the bleak world of her hostel and group therapy and swept her, once a week, into a whirl of expensive fun. Strike noted how very little Rochelle had told him about Lula the person, as opposed to Lula the holder of the magic plastic cards that bought handbags, jackets and jewellery, and the necessary means by which Kieran appeared regularly, like a genie, to whisk Rochelle away from her hostel. She described, in loving detail, the presents Lula had bought her, shops to which Lula had taken her, restaurants and bars to which they had gone together, places lined with celebrities. None of these, however, seemed to have impressed Rochelle in the slightest. For every name she mentioned, there was a deprecating remark.
He was a dick. She's plastic all over. There ain't nothing special.
Did you meet Evan Duffield? Strike asked.
Him.
The monosyllable was heavy with contempt.
He's a twat.
Is he?
Yeah, he is. Ask Kieran.
She gave the impression that she and Kieran stood together, sane, dispassionate observers of the idiots populating Lula's world.
In what way was he a twat? He treated her like shit.
Like how?
Sold stories, said Rochelle, reaching for the last of her fries. One time she tested everyone, told us all a different story to see which ones got in the papers. I was the only one who kept their mouth shut. Everyone else blabbed.
Who'd she test?
Kiara Porter? Him, Duffield? That guy, Summy? But then she reckoned it wasn't him. Made excuses for him. But I used her as much as anyone.
In what way?
He didn't want her to work for anyone else. Wanted her to do it all for his company, get him all the publicity.
So after she found out she could trust you...
Yeah. Then she bought me the phone.
There was a missed beat.
So she could get in touch with me whenever she wanted.
She swept the sparkling pink Nokia suddenly off the table and stuffed it deep into the pocket of her squashy pink coat.
I suppose you've had to take over the charges yourself now, Strike asked.
He thought that she was going to tell him to mind his own business, but instead she said,
Her family hasn't noticed, they're still paying for it.
And this thought seemed to give her a slightly malicious pleasure.
Did Lula buy you that jacket?
Strike asked.
No,
she snapped, furiously defensive.
I got this myself, I'm working now.
Really? Where are you working?
What's it to you?
She demanded again.
I'm showing polite interest.
A tiny, brief smile touched the wide mouth, and she relented again.
I'm doing afternoons in a shop up the road from my new place.
Are you in another hostel?
No,
she said. And he sensed again the digging in, the refusal to go further, that he would push at his peril. He changed tack.
It must have been a shock to you when Lula died, was it?
Yeah, it was,
she said thoughtlessly. Then, realizing what she had said, she backtracked.
I knew she was depressed, but I never expect people to do that.
So you wouldn't say she was suicidal when you saw her that day?
I don't know. I never saw her for long enough, did I?
Where were you when you heard she died?
I was in the hostel. Loads of people knew I knew her. Janine woke me up and told me.
And your immediate thought was that it was suicide?
Yeah. And I gotta go now, I gotta go.
She had made up her mind, and he could see that he was not going to be able to stop her. After wriggling back into the ludicrous fur jacket, she hoisted her handbag onto her shoulder.
Say hello to Kieran for me.
Yeah, I will.
See ya.
She waddled out of the restaurant without a backward glance. Strike watched her walk past the window, her head down, her brows knitted, until she passed out of sight. It had stopped raining. Idly, he pulled her tray towards him and finished her last few fries. Then he stood up so abruptly that the baseball-capped girl who had been approaching his table to clear and wipe it jumped back a step with a little cry of surprise. Strike hurried out of the McDonald's and off up Gruntly Road. Rochelle was standing on the corner, clearly visible in her furry magenta coat, part of a knot of people waiting for the lights to change at a pedestrian crossing. She was gabbling into the pink jeweled Nokia. Strike caught up with her, insinuating himself into the group behind her, making of his bulk a weapon, so that people moved aside to avoid him.
Wanted to know who she was arranging to meet that night. Yeah, and...
Rochelle turned her head, watching traffic, and realized that Strike was right behind her. Removing the mobile from her ear, she jabbed at a button, cutting the call.
What?
She asked him aggressively.
Who were you calling, then?
Mind your own fucking business,
she said furiously. The waiting pedestrian stared.
Are you following me?
Yeah,
said Strike.
Listen.
The lights changed. They were the only two not to start off over the road, and were jostled by the passing walkers. Will you give me your mobile number? The implacable bull's eyes looked back at him, unreadable, bland, secretive.
What for?
Kieran asked me to get it, he lied. I forgot. He thinks you left a pair of sunglasses in his car.
He did not think she was convinced, but after a moment she dictated a number, which he wrote down on the back of one of his own cards.
That all?
She asked aggressively, and she proceeded across the road as far as an island, where the lights changed again. Strike limped after her. She looked both angry and perturbed by his continuing presence.
What?
I think you know something you're not telling me, Rochelle.
She glared at him.
Take this, said Strike, pulling a second card out of his overcoat pocket. If you think of anything you'd like to tell me, call. All right. Call that mobile number.
She did not answer.
If Lula was murdered,
said Strike, while the cars whooshed by them and rain glittered in the gutters at their feet,
and you know something, you could be in danger from the killer too.
This evoked a tiny, complacent, scathing smile. Rochelle did not think she was in danger. She thought she was safe. The green man had appeared. Rochelle gave a toss of her dry, wiry hair and moved away across the road, ordinary, squat and plain, still clutching her mobile in one hand and Strike's card in the other. Strike stood alone on the island, watching her with a feeling of impotence and unease. She might never have sold her story to the newspapers, but he could not believe that she had bought that designer jacket, ugly though he found it, from the proceeds of a job in a shop.
Chapter 9.
The junction of Tottenham Court and Charing Cross Roads was still a scene of devastation, with wide gashes in the road, white hardboard tunnels, and hard-hatted builders. Strike traversed the narrow walkways barricaded by metal fences, past the rumbling diggers full of rubble, bellowing workmen, and more drills, smoking as he walked. He felt weary and sore, very conscious of the pain in his leg, of his unwashed body, of the greasy food lying heavily in his stomach. On impulse, he took a detour right up Sutton Row, away from the clatter and grind of the roadworks, and called Rochelle. It went to voicemail, but it was her husky voice that answered. She had not given him a fake number. He left no message. He had already said everything he could think of saying, and yet he was worried. He half wished he had followed her, covertly, to find out where she was living. Back on Charing Cross Road, limping onto the office through the temporary shadow of the pedestrian tunnel, he remembered the way that Robin had woken him up that morning, the tactful knock, the cup of tea, the studied avoidance of the subject of the camp bed. He ought not to have let it happen. There were other routes to intimacy than admiring a woman's figure in a tight dress. He did not want to explain why he was sleeping at work. He dreaded personal questions. And he had let a situation arise in which she had called him Cormoran and told him to do up his buttons. He ought never to have overslept. As he climbed the metal stairs, past the closed door of Crowdy Graphics, Strike resolved to treat Robin with a slightly cooler edge of authority for the rest of the day, to counterbalance that glimpse of hairy belly. The decision was no sooner made than he heard high-pitched laughter and two female voices talking at the same time, issuing from his own office. Strike froze, listening, panicking. He had not returned Charlotte's call. He tried to make out her tone and inflection. It would be like her to come in person and overwhelm his temp with charm, to make of his ally a friend, to saturate his own staff with Charlotte's version of the truth. The two voices melded in laughter again, and he could not tell whose they were.
"Hi, Stick," said a cheery voice as he pushed open the glass door.
His sister Lucy was sitting on the sagging sofa, with her hands around a mug of coffee, bags from Marks and Spencer and John Lewis heaped all around her. Strike's first surge of relief that she was not Charlotte was nevertheless tainted with a lesser dread of what she and Robin had been talking about, and how much each of them now knew about his private life. As he returned Lucy's hug, he noticed that Robin had, again, closed the inner door on the camp bed and kit bag.
"Robin says you've been out detecting."
Lucy seemed in high spirits, as she so often was when she was out alone, unencumbered by Greg and the boys.
"Yes, we do that sometimes, detectives," said Strike.
"Been shopping?"
"Yes, Sherlock, I have."
"Do you want to go out for a coffee?"
"I've already got one, Stick," she said, holding up the mug.
"You're not very sharp today. Are you limping a bit?"
"Not that I've noticed."
"Have you seen Mr. Chakrabarty recently?"
"Fairly recently," lied Strike.
"If it's all right," said Robin, who was putting on her trench coat, "I'll take lunch, Mr. Strike. I haven't had any yet."
The resolution of moments ago to treat her with professional froid now seemed not only unnecessary, but unkind. She had more tact than any woman he had ever met.
"That's fine, Robin, yeah," he said.
"Nice to meet you, Lucy," Robin said. And with a wave, she disappeared, closing the glass door behind her.
"I really like her," said Lucy enthusiastically, as Robin's footsteps clanged away.
"She's great. You should try and get her to stay on permanently."
"Yeah, she's good," said Strike.
"What were you two having such a laugh about?"
"Oh, her fiancé. He sounds a bit like Greg."
"Robin says you've got an important case on."
"It's all right, she was very discreet. She says it's a suspicious suicide."
"That can't be very nice."
She gave him a meaningful look he chose not to understand.
"Well, it's not the first time. I had a couple of those in the army, too."
But he doubted that Lucy was listening. She had taken a deep breath. He knew what was coming.
"Stick, have you and Charlotte split up?"
"Better get it over with." "Yeah, we have."
"Stick."
"It's fine, Luce, I'm fine."
But her good humour had been obliterated in a great gush of fury and disappointment. Strike waited patiently, exhausted and sore, while she raged. She had known all along. Known that Charlotte would do it all over again. She had lured him away from Tracy and from his fantastic army career, rendered him as insecure as possible, persuaded him to move in, only to dump him.
"I ended it, Luce," he said. "And Tracy and I were over before—"
But he might as well have commanded lava to flow backwards. Why hadn't he realized that Charlotte would never change, that she had only returned to him for the drama of the situation, attracted by his injury and his medal? The bitch had played the ministering angel and then got bored. She was dangerous and wicked, measuring her own worth in the havoc she caused, glorying in the pain she inflicted.
"I left her. It was my choice."
"Where have you been living? When did this happen?
That absolute bloody bitch. No, I'm sorry, Stick. I'm not going to pretend any more. All the years and years of shit she's put you through. Oh, God, Stick, why didn't you marry Tracy?"
"Luce, let's not do this, please."
He moved aside some of her John Lewis bags, full, he saw, of small pants and socks for her sons, and sat down heavily on the sofa. He knew he looked grubby and scruffy. Lucy seemed on the verge of tears. Her day out in town was ruined.
"I suppose you haven't told me because you knew I'd do this,"
she said at last, gulping.
"It might have been a consideration."
"All right, I'm sorry,"
she said furiously, her eyes shining with tears.
"But that bitch, Stick. Oh, God, tell me you're never going to go back to her. Please, just tell me that."
"I'm not going back to her."
"Where are you staying? Nick and Ilse's?"
"No, I've got a little place in Hammersmith."
The first place that occurred to him, associated now with homelessness.
"Bedsit."
"Oh, Stick. Come and stay with us."
He had a fleeting vision of the all-blue spare room and Greg's forced smile.
"Luce, I'm happy where I am. I just want to get on with work and be on my own for a bit."
It took him another half hour to shift her out of his office. She felt guilty that she had lost her temper, apologized, then attempted to justify herself, which triggered another diatribe about Charlotte. When she finally decided to leave, he helped her downstairs with her bags, successfully distracting her from the boxes full of his possessions that still stood on the landing, and finally depositing her into a black cab at the end of Denmark Street. Her round, mascara-streaked face looked back at him out of the rear window. He forced a grin and a wave before lighting another cigarette, and reflecting that Lucy's idea of sympathy compared unfavourably with some of the interrogation techniques they had used at Guantanamo.
Chapter 10.
Robin had fallen into the habit of buying Strike a pack of sandwiches with her own, if he happened to be in the office over lunchtime, and reimbursing herself from petty cash. Today, however, she did not hurry back. She had noticed, though Lucy had seemed oblivious, how unhappy Strike had been to find them in conversation. His expression, when he had entered the office, had been every bit as grim as the first time they had met. Robin hoped that she had not said anything to Lucy that Strike would not like. Lucy had not exactly pried, but she had asked questions to which it was difficult to know the answer. "Have you met Charlotte yet?" Robin guessed that this was the stunning ex-wife or girlfriend whose exit she had witnessed on her first morning. Near collision hardly constituted a meeting, however, so she answered, "No, I haven't." "Funny." Lucy had given a disingenuous little smile. "I'd have thought she'd have wanted to meet you." For some reason, Robin had felt prompted to reply, "I'm only temporary." "Still," said Lucy, who seemed to understand the answer better than Robin did herself. It was only now, wandering up and down the aisle of crisps without really concentrating on them, that the implications of what Lucy had said slid into place. Robin supposed that Lucy might have meant to flatter her, except that the mere possibility of Strike making any kind of pass was extremely distasteful to her.
"Matt, honestly, if you saw him, he's enormous and he's got a face like some beaten-up boxer. He's not remotely attractive. I'm sure he's over 40 and..."
She had cast around for more aspersions to cast upon Strike's appearance.
"He's got that sort of pubic hair."
Matthew had only really become reconciled to her continuing employment with Strike now that Robin had accepted the media consultancy job. Robin selected two bags of salt and vinegar crisps at random and headed towards the cash desk. She had not yet told Strike that she would be leaving in 2.5 weeks' time. Lucy had moved from the subject of Charlotte only to interrogate Robin on the amount of business coming through the shabby little office. Robin had been as vague as she dared, intuiting that if Lucy did not know how bad Strike's finances were, it was because he did not want her to know. Hoping that he would be pleased for his sister to think that business was good, she mentioned that his latest client was wealthy.
"Divorce case, is it?" asked Lucy.
"No," said Robin. "It's a... well, I've signed a confidentiality agreement. He's been asked to reinvestigate a suicide."
"Oh, God, that won't be fun for Cormoran," said Lucy, with a strange note in her voice.
Robin looked confused.
"Hasn't he told you?"
"Mind you, people usually know without telling."
"Our mother was a famous groupie, they call it, don't they?"
Lucy's smile was suddenly forced, and her tone, though she was striving for detachment and unconcern, had become brittle.
"It's all on the internet. Everything is these days, isn't it? She died of an overdose, and they said it was suicide. But Stick always thought her ex-husband did it. Nothing was ever proven. Stick was furious. It was all very sordid and horrible anyway. Perhaps that's why the client chose Stick. I take it the suicide was an overdose."
Robin did not reply, but it did not matter. Lucy went on without pausing for an answer.
"That's when Stick dropped out of university and joined the military police. The family was very disappointed. He's really bright, you know. Nobody in our family had ever been to Oxford, but he just packed up and left and joined the army. It seemed to suit him. He did really well there. I think it's a shame he left, to be honest. He could have stayed, even with, you know, his leg."
Robin did not betray, by so much as a flicker of her eyelid, that she did not know. Lucy sipped her tea.
"So, whereabouts in Yorkshire are you from?"
The conversation had flowed pleasantly after that, right up until the moment that Strike had walked in on them, laughing at Robin's description of Matthew's last excursion into DIY. But Robin, heading back to the office with sandwiches and crisps, felt even sorrier for Strike than she had done before. His marriage, or if they had not been married, his live-in relationship, had failed. He was sleeping in his office. He had been injured in the war, and now she discovered that his mother had died in dubious and squalid circumstances. She did not pretend to herself that this compassion was untinged with curiosity. She already knew that she would certainly, at some point in the near future, try and find the online particulars of Leda Strike's death. At the same time, she felt guilty that she had been given another glimpse of a part of Strike she had not been meant to see, like that patch of virtually furry belly he had accidentally exposed that morning. She knew him to be a proud and self-sufficient man. These were the things she liked and admired about him, even if the way these qualities expressed themselves, the camp bed, the boxed possessions on the landing, the empty pot noodle tubs in the bin, aroused the derision of such as Matthew, who assumed that anyone living in uncomfortable circumstances must have been profligate or feckless. Robin was not sure whether or not she imagined the slightly charged atmosphere in the office when she returned. Strike was sitting in front of her computer monitor, tapping away at the keyboard, and while he thanked her for the sandwiches, he did not, as was usual, turn away from work for 10 minutes for a chat about the Landry case.
"I need this for a couple of minutes. Would you be okay on the sofa?" he asked her, continuing to type.
Robin wondered whether Lucy had told Strike what they had discussed. She hoped not. Then she felt resentful for feeling guilty. After all, she had done nothing wrong. Her aggravation put a temporary stop on her great desire to know whether he had found Rochelle on Ifade.
"Aha," said Strike.
He had found, on the Italian designer's website, the magenta fake fur coat that Rochelle had been wearing that morning. It had become available for purchase only within the last 2 weeks, and it cost £1,500. Robin waited for Strike to explain the exclamation, but he did not. "Did you find her?" she asked, at last, when finally Strike turned from the computer to unwrap the sandwiches. He told her about their encounter, but all the enthusiasm and gratitude of that morning, when he had called her genius over and again, was absent. Robin's tone, as she gave him the results of her own telephone inquiries, was, therefore, similarly cool. "I called the Law Society about the conference in Oxford on January the 7th, she said. "Tony Landry attended. I pretended to be somebody he'd met there who'd mislaid his card." He did not seem particularly interested in the information he had requested, nor did he compliment her on her initiative. The conversation petered out in mutual dissatisfaction. The confrontation with Lucy had exhausted Strike. He wanted to be alone. He also suspected that Lucy might have told Robin about Leda. His sister deplored the fact that their mother had lived and died in conditions of mild notoriety, yet in certain moods she seemed to be seized with a paradoxical desire to discuss it all, especially with strangers. Perhaps it was a kind of safety valve, because of the tight lid she kept on her past with her suburban friends. Or perhaps she was trying to carry the fight into the enemy's territory, so anxious about what they might already know about her, that she tried to forestall prurient interest before it could start. But he had never wanted Robin to know about his mother, or about his leg, or about Charlotte, or any of the other painful subjects which Lucy insisted on probing whenever she came close enough. In his tiredness and his bad mood, Strike extended to Robin, unfairly, his blanket irritation at women who did not seem able just to leave a man in peace. He thought he might take his notes to the Tottenham this afternoon, where he would be able to sit and think without interruptions, and without being badgered for explanations. Robin felt the atmospheric change keenly. Taking her cue from the silently munching Strike, she brushed herself free of crumbs, then gave him the morning's messages in a brisk and impersonal tone. "John Bristow called with a mobile number for Marlene Higson. He's also got through to Guy Sommet, who could meet you at 10 o'clock on Thursday morning at his studio in Blunkett Street, if that suits. It's out in Chiswick, near Strand-on-the-Green."
"Great, thanks."
They said very little else to each other that day. Strike spent the greater part of the afternoon at the pub, returning only at 10 to 5. The awkwardness between them persisted, and for the first time, he was quite pleased to see Robin leave. Part 4. Optimumque est, ut volgo dixere aliena insania frui. And the best plan is, as the popular saying was, to profit by the folly of others. Pliny the Elder, Historia Naturalis. Chapter 1. Strike visited Yulu early to shower, and dressed with unusual care on the morning of his visit to the studio of Guy Sommet. He knew from his perusal of the designer's website that Sommet advocated the purchase and wear of such items as chaps in degraded leather, ties of metal mesh, and black-brimmed headbands that seemed to have been made by cutting the tops out of old bowlers. With a faint feeling of defiance, Strike put on the conventional, comfortable dark blue suit he had worn to Cipriani. The studio he sought had been a disused 19th-century warehouse which stood on the north bank of the Thames. The glittering river dazzled his eyes as he tried to find the entrance, which was not clearly marked. Nothing on the outside proclaimed the use to which the building was being put. At last he discovered a discreet, unmarked bell, and the door was opened electronically from within. The stark but airy hallway was chilly with air conditioning. A jingling and clacking noise preceded the entrance into the hall of a girl with tomato-red hair, dressed in head-to-toe black and wearing many silver bangles.
"Oh,"
she said, seeing Strike.
"I've got an appointment with Mr. Sommet at 10, he told her. "Cormor and Strike."
"Oh,"
she said again.
"Okay."
She disappeared the same way she had come. Strike used the wait to call the mobile telephone number of Rochelle Onifade, as he had been doing 10 times a day since he had met her. There was no response. Another minute passed, and then a small black man was suddenly crossing the floor towards Strike, cat-like and silent on rubber soles. He walked with an exaggerated swing of his hips, his upper body quite still, except for a little counterbalancing sway of the shoulders, his arms almost rigid. Guy Sommet was nearly a foot shorter than Strike, and had perhaps 1/100th of his body fat. The front of the designer's tight black T-shirt was decorated with hundreds of tiny silver studs, which formed an apparently three-dimensional image of Elvis's face, as though his chest were a pin-art toy. The eye was further confused by the fact that a well-defined six-pack moved underneath the tight lycra. Sommet's snug grey jeans bore a faint dark pinstripe, and his trainers seemed to be made out of black suede and patent leather. His face contrasted strangely with his taut, lean body, for it abounded in exaggerated curves. The eyes exophthalmic, so that they appeared fish-like, looking out of the sides of his head. The cheeks were round, shining apples, and the full-lipped mouth was a wide oval. His small head was almost perfectly spherical. Sommet looked as though he had been carved out of soft ebony by a master hand that had grown bored with its own expertise and started to veer towards the grotesque. He held out a hand with a slight crook of the wrist.
"Yes, I can see a bit of Johnny," he said, looking up into Strike's face. His voice was camp and faintly cockney. "Much butcher, though."
Strike shook hands. There was surprising strength in the fingers. The red-haired girl came jingling back.
"I'll be busy for an hour, Trudy, no calls," Sommet told her. "Bring us some tea and bix, darling."
He executed a dancer's turn, beckoning to Strike to follow him. Down a whitewashed corridor they passed an open door, and a flat-faced, middle-aged Oriental woman stared back at Strike through the gauzy film of gold stuff she was throwing over a dummy. The room around her was as brilliantly lit as a surgical theatre, but full of workbenches, cramped and cluttered with bolts of fabric, the walls a collage of fluttering sketches, photographs, and notes. A tiny blonde woman, dressed in what appeared to Strike to be a giant black tubular bandage, opened a door and crossed the corridor in front of them. She gave him precisely the same cold, blank stare as the red-haired Trudy. Strike felt abnormally huge and hairy, a woolly mammoth attempting to blend in among capuchin monkeys. He followed the strutting designer to the end of the corridor and up a spiral staircase of steel and rubber, at the top of which was a large white rectangular office space. Floor-to-ceiling windows all along the right-hand side showed a stunning view of the Thames and the South Bank. The rest of the whitewash walls were hung with photographs. What arrested Strike's attention was an enormous 12-foot-tall blow-up of the infamous Fallen Angels on the wall opposite Sir May's desk. On closer inspection, however, he realized that it was not the shot with which the world was familiar. In this version, Lula had thrown back her head in laughter. The strong column of her throat rose vertically out of the long hair, which had become disarranged in her amusement, so that a single dark nipple protruded. Kiara Porter was looking up at Lula, the beginnings of laughter on her own face, but slower to get the joke. The viewer's attention was drawn, as in the more famous version of the picture, immediately to Lula. She was represented elsewhere, everywhere. There on the left, among a group of models all wearing transparent shifts in rainbow colours, further along in profile, with gold leaf on her lips and eyelids. Had she learned how to compose her face into its most photogenic arrangement to project emotion so beautifully? Or had she simply been a pellucid surface through which her feelings naturally shone?
"Park your arse anywhere," said Sir May, dropping into a seat behind a dark wooden steel desk covered in sketches.
Strike pulled up a chair composed of a single length of contorted perspex. There was a T-shirt lying on the desk, which carried a picture of Princess Diana as a garish Mexican Madonna, glittering with bits of glass and beads, and complete with a flaming scarlet heart of shining satin, on which an embroidered crown was perched lopsided.
"You like?" said Sir May,
noticing the direction of Strike's gaze.
"Oh, yeah," lied Strike.
"Sold out nearly everywhere. Bad taste letters from Catholics. Joe Mancura wore one on Jules Holland. I'm thinking of doing William as Christ on a long sleeve for winter. Or Harry, do you think, with an AK-47 to hide his cock?"
Strike smiled vaguely. Sir May crossed his legs with a little more flourish than was strictly necessary, and said, with startling bravado,
"So, the accountant thinks Cuckoo might have been killed. I always called Lula Cuckoo," he added, unnecessarily.
"Yeah. John Bristow's a lawyer, though."
"I know he is, but Cuckoo and I always called him the accountant. Well, I did, and Cuckoo sometimes joined in if she was feeling wicked. He was forever nosing into her percentages and trying to wring every last cent out of everyone. I suppose his pair knew the detective equivalent of the minimum wage."
"He's paying me a double wage, actually."
"Oh, well, he's probably a bit more generous now he's got Cuckoo's money to play with."
Sir May chewed on a fingernail, and Strike was reminded of Kieran Colobus-Jones. The designer and driver were similar in build too, small but well-proportioned.
"All right, I'm being a bitch," said Sir May, taking his nail out of his mouth. "I never liked John Bristow. He was always on Cuckoo's case about something. Get a life. Get out of the closet. Have you heard him rhapsodising about his mummy? Have you met his girlfriend? Talk about a beard. I think she's got one."
He rattled out the words in one nervy, spiteful stream, pausing to open a hidden drawer in the desk, from which he took out a packet of menthol cigarettes. Strike had already noticed that Sir May's nails were bitten to their quicks.
"Her family was the whole reason she was so fucked up. I used to tell her, 'Drop 'em, sweetie, move on,' but she wouldn't. That was Cuckoo for you, always flogging a dead horse."
He offered Strike one of the pure white cigarettes, which the detective declined, before lighting one with an engraved Zippo. As he flipped the lid of the lighter shut, Sir May said,
"I wish I'd thought of calling in a private detective. It never occurred to me. I'm glad someone's done it. I just cannot believe she committed suicide. My therapist says that's denial. I'm having therapy twice a week. Not that it makes any fucking difference. I'd be snaffling Valium like Lady Bristow if I could still design when I'm on it. But I tried it the week after Cuckoo died, and I was like a zombie. I suppose it got me through the funeral."
jingling and rattling from the spiral staircase, announced the reappearance of Trudy, who emerged through the floor in jerky stages. She laid upon the desk a black lacquered tray, on which stood two silver filigree Russian tea glasses, in each of which was a pale green steaming concoction with wilted leaves floating in it. There was also a plate of wafer-thin biscuits that looked as though they might be made of charcoal. Strike remembered his pie and mash and his mahogany-coloured tea at the Phoenix with nostalgia. "Thanks, Trudy. Get me an ashtray, darling." The girl hesitated, clearly on the verge of protesting.
"Just do it," snarled Sommet. "I'm the fucking boss. I'll burn the building down if I want to, pull the fucking batteries out of the fire alarms, but get the ashtray first."
"The alarm went off last week and set up all the sprinklers downstairs," Sommet explained to Strike. "So now the backers don't want anyone smoking in the building. They can stick that one right up their tight little bum holes." He inhaled deeply, then exhaled through his nostrils.
"Don't you ask questions? Or do you just sit there looking scary until someone blurts out a confession?"
"We can do questions," said Strike, pulling out his notebook and pen. "You were abroad when Lula died, weren't you?"
"I'd just got back a couple of hours before."
Sommet's fingers twitched a little on the cigarette.
"I'd been in Tokyo, hardly any sleep for 8 days. Touched down at Heathrow at about 10:30 with the most fucking appalling jet lag. I can't sleep on planes. I want to be awake if I'm going to crash."
"How did you get home from the airport?"
"Cab. Elsa had fucked up my car booking. There should have been a driver there to meet me."
"Who's Elsa?"
"The girl I sacked for fucking up my car booking. It was the last thing I fucking wanted, to have to find a cab at that time of night."
"Do you live alone?"
"No. By midnight I was tucked up in bed with Victor and Rolf. My cats," he added with a flicker of a grin. "I took an Ambien, slept for a few hours, then woke up at 5 in the morning. I switched on Sky News from the bed, and there was a man in a horrible sheepskin hat standing in the snow in Cuckoo Street saying she was dead. The ticker tape across the bottom of the screen was saying it too."
Sommet inhaled heavily on the cigarette, and white smoke curled out of his mouth with his next words.
"I nearly fucking died. I thought I was still asleep, or that I'd woken up in the wrong fucking dimension or something. I started calling everyone, Kiara, Bryony, all their phones were engaged. And all the time I was watching the screen, thinking they'd flash up something saying there had been a mistake, that it wasn't her. I kept praying it was the bag lady, Rochelle."
He paused, as though he expected some comment from Strike. The latter, who had been making notes as Sommet spoke, asked, still writing, "You know Rochelle, do you?"
"Yeah. Cuckoo brought her in here once. In it for all she could get."
"What makes you say that?"
"She hated Cuckoo, jealous as fuck. I could see it even if Cuckoo couldn't. She was in it for the freebies. She didn't give a monkey's whether Cuckoo lived or died. Lucky for her, as it turned out. So the longer I watched the news, I knew there wasn't a mistake. I fell a fucking part."
His fingers trembled a little on the snow-white stick he was sucking.
"They said that a neighbour had overheard an argument. So, of course, I thought it was Duffield. I thought Duffield had knocked her through the window. I was all set to tell the pigs what a cunt he is. I was ready to stand in the dock and testify to the fucker's character. And if this ash falls off my cigarette," he continued in precisely the same tone, "I will fire that little bitch."
As though she had heard him, Trudy's rapid footfalls grew louder and louder until she emerged again into the room, breathing heavily and clutching a heavy glass ashtray.
"Thank you," said Sommet, with a pointed inflection, as she placed it in front of him and scurried back downstairs.
"Why did you think it was Duffield?"
asked Strike, once he judged Trudy to be safely out of earshot.
"Who else would Cuckoo have let in at 2 in the morning?
"How well do you know him?"
"Well enough, little pissant that he is."
Sommet picked up his mint tea.
"Why do women do it? Cuckoo, too, she wasn't stupid, actually. She was razor sharp. So what did she see in Evan Duffield? I'll tell you," he said, without pausing for an answer. "It's that wounded poet crap. That soul pain shit. That too much of a tortured genius to wash bollocks. Brush your teeth, you little bastard. You're not fucking Byron. He slammed his glass down and cupped his right elbow in his left hand, steadying his forearm and continuing to draw heavily on the cigarette. No man would put up with the likes of Duffield, only women. Maternal instinct gone warped, if you ask me. You think he had it in him to kill her, do you? Of course I do, said Sommet dismissively. Of course he has. All of us have got it in us, somewhere, to kill, so why would Duffield be any exception? He's got the mentality of a vicious 12-year-old. I can imagine him in one of his rages, having a tantrum and then just... With his cigarette-free hand, he made a violent shoving movement. I saw him shouting at her once, at my after-show party last year. I got in between them. I told him to have a go at me instead. I might be a little puff, Sommet said. The round-cheeked face set. But I'd back myself against that drugged-up fuck any day. He was a tit at the funeral, too.
Really?
Yeah, lurching around, off his face, no fucking respect. I was full of tranks myself, or I'd have told him what I thought of him. Pretending to be devastated, hypocritical little shit.
You never thought it was suicide?
Sommet's strange, bulging eyes bored into strike. Never. Duffield says he was at his dealer's, disguised as a wolf. What kind of fucking alibi is that? I hope you're checking him out. I hope you're not dazzled by his fucking celebrity, like the police.
Strike remembered Wardle's comments on Duffield.
I don't think they found Duffield dazzling.
They've got more taste than I credited them with, then, said Sommet.
Why are you so sure it wasn't suicide? Lula had had mental health problems, hadn't she?
Yeah, but we had a pact, like Marilyn Monroe and Montgomery Clift. We'd sworn that if either of us was thinking seriously of killing themselves, we'd call the other. She would have called me.
When did you last hear from her?
She phoned me on the Wednesday while I was still in Tokyo, said Sommet. Silly cow always forgot it was 8 hours ahead. I had my phone on mute at 2 in the morning, so I didn't pick up. But she left a message, and she was not suicidal. Listen to this.
He reached into his desk drawer again, pressed several buttons, then held the mobile out to Strike. And Lula Landry spoke close and real, slightly raw and throaty in Strike's ear, in deliberately affected mockney.
All right, darling. Got something to tell ya. I'm not sure whether you're going to like it, but it's a biggie and I'm so fucking happy I've got to tell someone. So ring me when you can, okay? Can't wait. Mwah, mwah.
Strike handed back the phone.
Did you call her back? Did you find out what the big news was?
No.
Sommet ground out his cigarette and reached immediately for another one.
The Japs had me in back-to-back meetings. Every time I thought of calling her, the time difference was in the way. Anyway, to tell you the truth, I thought I knew what she was going to say, and I wasn't any too fucking pleased about it. I thought she was pregnant.
Sommet nodded several times with the fresh cigarette clutched between his teeth. Then he removed it to say,
"Yeah, I thought she'd gone and got herself knocked up."
"By Duffield?"
I hoped to fuck not. I didn't know at the time that they got back together. She wouldn't have dared hook up with him if I'd been in the country, no. She waited till I was in Japan, the sneaky little bitch. She knew I hated him, and she cared what I thought. We were like family, Cuckoo and me.
Why did you think she might be pregnant?
It was the way she sounded. You've heard it. She was so excited. I had this feeling. It was the kind of thing Cuckoo would have done. And she'd have expected me to be as pleased as she was, and fuck her career, fuck me, counting on her to launch my brand new accessories line.
Was this the £5 million contract her brother told me about?
Yeah, and I'll bet the accountant pushed her to hold out for as much as she could get too, said Sommet, with another flash of temper. It wasn't like Cuckoo to try and wring every last penny out of me. She knew it was going to be fabulous, and would take her to a whole new level if she fronted it. It shouldn't have been all about the money. Everyone associated her with my stuff. Her big break came on a shoot for Vogue when she wore my jagged dress. Cuckoo loved my clothes. She loved me. But people get to a certain level, and everyone's telling them they're worth more, and they forget who put them there, and suddenly it's all about the bottom line.
You must have thought she was worth it, to commit to a £5 million contract.
Yeah, well, I'd pretty much designed the range for her, so having to shoot around a fucking pregnancy wouldn't have been funny. And I could just imagine Cuckoo going silly afterwards, throwing it all in, not wanting to leave the fucking baby. She was the type. Always looking for people to love, for a surrogate family. Those Bristows fucked her up good. They only adopted her as a toy for Yvette, who was the scariest bitch in the world.
In what way?
Possessive, morbid. Didn't want to let Cuckoo out of her sight in case she died, like the kid she'd been bought to replace. Lady Bristow used to come to all the shows, getting under everyone's feet, till she got too ill. And there was an uncle, who treated Cuckoo like scum until she started pulling in big money. He got a bit more respectful then. They all know the value of a buck, the Bristows.
They're a wealthy family, aren't they?
Alec Bristow didn't leave that much, not relatively speaking. Not compared to proper money. Not like your old man. How come, said Sommet, swerving suddenly off the conventional track, Johnny Ropeby's son's working as a private dick?
Because that's his job, said Strike. Go on about the Bristows.
Sommet did not appear to resent being bossed around. If anything, he seemed to relish it, possibly because it was such an unusual experience. I just remember Cuckoo telling me that most of what Alec Bristow left was in shares in his old company, and Albris has gone down the pan in the recession. It's hardly fucking Apple. Cuckoo had out-earned the whole fucking lot of them before she was 20.
"Was that picture," said Strike, indicating the enormous Fallen Angels image on the wall behind him, "part of the £5 million campaign?"
"Yeah," said Sommet. "Those four bags were the start of it. She's holding Kashiel there. I gave them all African names for her. She was fixated on Africa. That whorish real mother she unearthed had told her her father was African, so Cuckoo had gone mad on it, talking about studying there, doing voluntary work. Never mind that the old slapper had probably been sleeping with about 50 yardies, African,"
said Guy Sommet, grinding out his cigarette stub in the glass ashtray.
"My Aunt Fanny. The bitch just told Cuckoo what she wanted to hear."
"And you decided to go ahead and use the picture for the campaign, even though Lula had just..."
"It was meant as a fucking tribute!"
Sommet spoke loudly over him. "She never looked more beautiful. It was supposed to be a fucking tribute to her, to us. She was my muse. If the bastards couldn't understand that, fuck 'em, that's all. The press in this country are lower than scum, judging everyone by their fucking selves."
The day before she died, some handbags were sent to Lula.
"Yeah, they were mine. I sent her one of each of those," said Sommet, indicating the picture with the end of a new cigarette. "And I sent D.B. Mack some clothes by the same courier."
"Had he ordered them or..."
"Freebies, dear," drawled Sommet. "Just good business. Couple of customised hoodies and some accessories. Celebrity endorsements never hurt."
"Did he ever wear the stuff?"
"I don't know," said Sommet, in a more subdued tone. "I had other things to worry about the next day."
"I've seen YouTube footage of him wearing a hoodie with studs on it, like that," said Strike, pointing at Sommet's chest. "Making a fist."
"Yeah, that was one of them. Someone must have sent the stuff on to him. One had a fist, one had a handgun, and some of his lyrics on the backs."
"Did Lula talk to you about D.B. Mack coming to stay in the flat downstairs?"
"Oh, yeah. She wasn't nearly excited enough. I kept saying to her, babes, if he'd written 3 tracks about me, I'd be waiting behind the front door naked when he got in."
Sommet blew smoke in 2 long streams from his nostrils, looking sideways at Strike.
"I like 'em big and rough," he said. "But Cuckoo didn't.
Well, look what she hooked up with.
I kept telling her, you're the one making all this fucking song and dance about your roots. Find yourself a nice black boy and settle down. DB would have been fucking perfect. Why not? Last season's show, I had her walking down the catwalk to DB's Butterface Girl. Bitch, you ain't all that. Get a mirror that don't fool you. Give it up and tone it down, girl, because you ain't no fucking Lula. Duffield hated it.
Sir May smoked for a moment in silence, his eyes on the wall of photographs. Strike asked, "Where do you live?" "Around here," though he knew the answer.
"No, I'm in Charles Street in Kensington," said Sir May. "Moved there last year. It's a long fucking way from Acne, I can tell you. But it was getting silly, I had to leave. Too much hassle." "I grew up in Hackney," he explained, "back when I was plain old Kevin Owusu. I changed me name when I left home, like you."
"I was never Rokeby," said Strike, flicking over a page in his notebook. "My parents weren't married."
"We all know that, dear," said Sir May, with another flash of malice. "I dressed your old man for a Rolling Stone shoot last year. Skinny suit and broken bowler. Do you see him much?"
"No," said Strike.
"No, well, you'd make him look fucking old, wouldn't you?" said Sir May with a cackle. He fidgeted in his seat, lit yet another cigarette, clamped it between his lips and squinted at Strike through billows of menthol smoke. "Why are we talking about me, anyway? Do people usually start telling you their life stories when you get out that notebook?"
"Sometimes."
"Don't you want your tea?"
"I don't blame you.
I don't know why I drink this shit. My old dad would have a coronary if he asked for a cup of tea and got this." "Is your family still in Hackney?"
"I haven't checked," said Sir May.
"We don't talk. I practice what I preach, see?"
"Why do you think Lula changed her name?"
"Because she hated her fucking family, same as me. She didn't want to be associated with them anymore."
"Why choose the same name as her Uncle Tony, then?"
"He's not famous. It made a good name.
DB couldn't have written double L-U-B mine if she'd been Lula Bristow, could he?" "Charles Street isn't too far from Kentigun Gardens, is it?"
"About a 20-minute walk. I wanted Cuckoo to move in with me when she said she couldn't stand her old place anymore, but she wouldn't. She chose that fucking 5-star prison instead, just to get away from the press. They drove her into that place. They bear responsibility."
Strike remembered DB Mack. The motherfucking press chased her out that window.
"She took me to see it. Mayfair. Full of rich Russians and Arabs and bastards like Freddy Bastigui. I said to her, 'Sweetie, you can't live here. Marble everywhere. Marble isn't chic in our climate. It's like living in your own tomb.'" He faltered, then went on. "She'd been through this headfuck for a few months. There'd been a stalker who was hand-delivering letters through her front door at 3 in the morning. She kept getting woken up by the letterbox going. The things he said he wanted to do to her, it scared her. Then she split up with Duffield, and she had the paps round the front of her house all the bloody time. Then she finds out they're hacking all her calls. And then she had to go and find that bitch of a mother. It was all getting too much. She wanted to be away from it all, to feel secure. I told her to move in with me. But instead she went and bought that fucking mausoleum. She took it because it felt like a fortress with round-the-clock security. She thought she'd be safe from everyone, that nobody would be able to get at her. But she hated it from the word go. I knew she would. She was cut off from everything she liked. Cuckoo loved colour and noise. She liked being on the street. She liked walking, being free. One of the reasons the police said it wasn't murder was the open windows. She'd opened them herself. It was only her prints on the handles. But I know why she opened them. She always opened the windows, even when it was freezing cold, because she couldn't stand the silence. She liked being able to hear London."
Sir May's voice had lost all its slyness and sarcasm. He cleared his throat and went on.
"She was trying to connect with something real. We used to talk about it all the time. It was our big thing. That's what made her get involved with Bloody Rochelle. It was a case of there but for the grace of God. Cuckoo thought that's what she'd have been if she hadn't been beautiful. if the Bristows hadn't taken her in as a little plaything for Yvette.
Tell me about this stalker.
Mental case. He thought they were married or something. He was given a restraining order and compulsory psychiatric treatment.
Any idea where he is now?
I think he was deported back to Liverpool, said Sir May. But the police checked him out. They told me he was in a secure ward up there the night she died.
Do you know the Bestiguis?
Only what Lula told me, that he was sleazy and she's a walking waxwork. I don't need to know her. I know her type. Rich girls spending their ugly husband's money. They come to my shows. They want to be my friend. Give me an honest hooker any day.
Freddie Bestigui was at the same country house weekend as Lula, a week before she died.
Yeah, I heard. He had a hard-on for her, said Sir May dismissively. She knew it as well. It wasn't exactly a unique experience in her life, you know. He never got further than trying to get in the same lift, though, from what she told me.
You never spoke to her after their weekend at Dickie Carberry's, did you?
No. Did he do something, then? You don't suspect Bestigui, do you?
Sir May sat up in his seat, staring.
Fuck. Freddie Bestigui. Well, he's a shit, I know that. This little girl I know, well, a friend of a friend, she was working for his production company, and he tried to fucking rape her. No, I am not exaggerating, said Sir May. Literally, rape. Got her a bit drunk after work and had her on the floor. Some assistant had forgotten his mobile and came back for it and walked in on them. Bestigui paid them both off. Everyone was telling her to press charges, but she took the money and ran. They say he used to discipline his second wife in some pretty fucking kinky ways. That's why she walked away with $3 mil. She threatened him with the press. But Cuckoo would never have let Freddie Bestigui into her flat at 2 in the morning. Like I say, she wasn't a stupid girl.
What do you know about Derek Wilson?
Who's he?
The security guard who was on duty the night she died.
Nothing.
He's a big guy with a Jamaican accent.
This might shock you, but not all the black people in London know each other.
I wonder whether you'd ever spoken to him, or heard Lula talk about him.
No, we had more interesting things to talk about than the security guard.
But does the same apply to her driver, Kieran Colovis-Jones?
Oh, I know who Colovis-Jones is, said Sir May with a slight smirk. Striking little poses whenever he thought I might be looking out of the window. He's about 5 fucking feet too short to model.
Did Lula ever talk about him?
No, why would she? Asked Sir May restlessly. He was her driver.
He's told me they were quite close. He mentioned that she'd given him a jacket you designed. Worth 900 quid.
Big fucking deal, said Sir May, with easy contempt. My proper stuff goes for upwards of 3 grand a coat. I slap the logo on shell suits and they sell like crazy, so it'd be silly not to.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, said Strike.
Your ready-to-wear line, is it?
Sir May looked amused.
That's right. That's the stuff that isn't made to measure, see? You buy it straight off the rack.
Right. How widely is that stuff sold?
It's everywhere. When were you last in a clothes shop? Asked Sir May, his wicked bulging eyes roving over Strike's dark blue jacket. What is that anyway, your D-mob suit?
When you say everywhere...
Smart department stores, boutiques, online, rattled off Sir May. Why?
One of two men caught on CCTV running away from Lula's area that night was wearing a jacket with your logo on it.
Sir May twitched his head very slightly, a gesture of repudiation and irritation. Him and 1 million other people.
Didn't you see?
I didn't look at any of that shit, said Sir May fiercely. All the coverage. I didn't want to read about it. I didn't want to think about it. I told them to keep it away from me, he said, gesturing towards the stairs and his staff. All I knew was that she was dead and Duffield was behaving like someone with something to hide. That's all I knew. That was enough.
Okay.
Still on the subject of clothes, in the last picture of Lula, the one where she was walking into the building, she seemed to be wearing a dress and a coat, Yeah, she was wearing Maribel and Fay, said Sommet. The dress was called Maribel...
Yeah, got it, said Strike.
But when she died, she was wearing something different. This seemed to surprise Sommet.
Was she?
Yeah, in the police pictures of the body. But Sommet threw up his arm in an involuntary gesture of refutation, of self-protection, then got to his feet, breathing hard, and walked to the photograph wall, where Lula stared out of several pictures, smiling, wistful, or serene. When the designer turned to face Strike again, the strange bulging eyes were wet.
"Fucking hell," he said in a low voice. "Don't talk about her like that. The body. Fucking hell. You're a cold-blooded bastard, aren't you? No fucking wonder old Johnny's not keen on you."
"I wasn't trying to upset you," said Strike calmly. "I only want to know whether you can think of any reason she'd have changed her clothes when she got home. When she fell, she was wearing trousers and a sequin top."
"How the fuck should I know why she changed?"
asked Sommet wildly.
"Maybe she was cold. Maybe she was... This is fucking ridiculous. How could I know that?"
"I'm only asking," said Strike. "I read somewhere that you told the press she died in one of your dresses."
"That wasn't me. I never announced it. Some tabloid bitch rang the office and asked for the name of that dress. One of the seamstresses told her, and they called her my spokesman, making out I'd try to get publicity out of it, the cunts. Fucking hell!"
"Do you think you could put me in touch with Kiara Porter and Bryony Radford?" Sommet seemed off balance, confused.
"What? Yeah."
But he had begun to cry in earnest, not like Bristow with wild gulps and sobs, but silently, with tears sliding down his smooth dark cheeks and onto his T-shirt. He swallowed and closed his eyes, turned his back on Strike, rested his forehead against the wall, and trembled. Strike waited in silence until Sommet had wiped his face several times and turned again towards him. He made no mention of his tears, but walked back to his chair, sat down, and lit a cigarette. After two or three deep drags, he said in a practical and unemotional voice,
"If she changed her clothes, it was because she was expecting someone. Cuckoo always dressed the part. She must have been waiting for someone."
"Well, that's what I thought," said Strike. "But I'm no expert on women and their clothes."
"No," said Sommet, with a ghost of his malicious smile.
"You don't look it. You want to speak to Kiara and Bryony?"
"It'd help."
"They're both doing a shoot for me on Wednesday. One Arlington Terrace in Islington. If you come along five-ish, they'd be free to talk to you."
"That's good of you. Thanks."
"It isn't good of me," said Sommet quietly. "I want to know what happened. When are you speaking to Duffield?"
"As soon as I can get hold of him. He thinks he's got away with it, the little shit.
She must have changed because she knew he was coming, mustn't she? Even though they'd rowed, she knew he'd follow her. But he'll never talk to you."
"He'll talk to me," said Strike easily, as he put away his notebook and checked his watch. "I've taken up a lot of your time. Thanks again." As Sommet led Strike back down the spiral stairs and along the white-walled corridor, some of his swagger returned to him. By the time they shook hands in the cool tiled lobby, no trace of distress remained on show.
"Lose some weight," he told Strike as a parting shot, "and I'll send you something XXL.
As the warehouse door swung closed behind Strike, he heard Sommet call to the tomato-haired girl at the desk.
"I know what you're thinking, Trudy. You're imagining him taking you roughly from behind, aren't you? Aren't you, darling? Big, rough soldier boy."
And Trudy's squeal of shocked laughter. Chapter 2.
Charlotte's acceptance of strike silence was unprecedented. There had been no further calls or texts. She was maintaining the pretense that their last filthy volcanic row had changed her irrevocably, stripped away her love, and purged her of fury. Strike, however, knew Charlotte as intimately as a germ that had lingered in his blood for 15 years, knew that her only response to pain was to wound the offender as deeply as possible, no matter what the cost to herself. What would happen if he refused her an audience, and kept refusing? It was the only strategy he had never tried, and all he had left. Every now and then, when Strike's resistance was low, late at night, alone on his camp bed, the infection would erupt again. Regret and longing would spike, and he saw her at close quarters, beautiful, naked, breathing words of love. Or weeping quietly, telling him that she knew she was rotten, ruined, impossible, but that he was the best and truest thing she had ever known. Then, the fact that he was a few press buttons away from speaking to her seemed too fragile a barricade against temptation, and he sometimes pulled himself back out of his sleeping bag and hopped in the darkness to Robin's abandoned desk, switching on the lamp and poring, even for hours, over the case report. Once or twice, he placed early morning calls to Rochelle on Ifade's mobile, but she never answered. On Thursday morning, Strike returned to the wall outside St. Thomas's and waited for 3 hours in the hope of seeing Rochelle again, but she did not turn up. He had Robin call the hospital, but this time they refused to comment on Rochelle's non-attendance and resisted all attempts at getting an address for her. On Friday morning, Strike returned from an outing to Starbucks to find Spanner sitting not on the sofa beside Robin's desk, but on the desk itself. He had an unlit roll-up in his mouth, and was leaning over her, apparently being more amusing than Strike had ever found him, because Robin was laughing in the slightly grudging manner of a woman who is entertained, but who wishes, nevertheless, to make it clear that the goal is well defended.
"Morning, Spanner," said Strike.
But the faintly repressive quality of his greeting did nothing to moderate either the computer specialist's ardent body language or his broad smile.
"All right, Fed. Brought your Dell back for you."
"Great. Double decaf latte," Strike told Robin,
setting the drink down beside her.
"No charge," he added, as she reached for her purse.
She was touchingly averse to charging minor luxuries to petty cash. Robin made no objection in front of their guest, but thanked Strike, and turned again to her work, which involved a small clockwise swivel of her desk chair, away from the two men. The flare of a match turned Strike's attention from his own double espresso to his guest.
"This is a non-smoking office, Spanner."
"What? You smoke like a fucking chimney."
"Not in here, I don't. Follow me."
Strike led Spanner into his own office and closed the door firmly behind him.
"She's engaged," he said, taking his usual seat.
"Wasting my powder, am I? Ah, well. Put in a word for me if the engagement goes down a pan. She's just my type."
"I don't think you're hers."
Spanner grinned knowingly.
"Already queuing, are you?"
"No," said Strike. "I just know her fiancé's a rugby-playing accountant. Clean-cut, square-jawed Yorkshireman."
He had formed a surprisingly clear mental image of Matthew, though he had never seen a photograph.
"You never know. She might fancy rebounding onto something a bit edgier," said Spanner,
swinging Lula Landry's laptop onto the desk and sitting down opposite Strike. He was wearing a slightly tatty sweatshirt and Jesus sandals on bare feet. It was the warmest day of the year so far.
"I've had a good look at this piece of crap. How much technical detail do you want?"
"None. But I need to know that you could explain it clearly in court."
Spanner looked, for the first time, truly intrigued.
"You serious?"
"Very. Would you be able to prove to a defending counsel that you know your stuff?"
"Course I could."
"Then just give me the important bits."
Spanner hesitated for a moment, trying to read Strike's expression. Finally he began, "Passwords, Agumon,
and it was reset 5 days before she died.
Spell it.
Spanner did so, adding to Strike's surprise. It's a surname, Ghanaian. She bookmarked the homepage of SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies, and it was on there. Look here.
As he spoke, Spanner's nimble fingers were clacking keyboard keys. He had brought up the homepage he described, bordered with bright green, with sections on the school, news, staff, students, library and so on.
When she died, though, it looked like this.
And with another outburst of clicking, he retrieved an almost identical page, featuring, as the rapidly darting cursor soon revealed, a link to the obituary of one Professor J.P. Aguman, Emeritus Professor of African Politics.
"She saved this version of the page," said Spanner, "and her internet history shows she browsed Amazon for his books in the month before she died. She was looking at a lot of books on African history and politics round then."
"Any evidence she applied to SOAS?"
"Not on here."
"Anything else of interest?"
"Well, the only other thing I noticed was that a big photo file was deleted off it on the 17th of March.
"How do you know that?"
"There's software that'll help you recover even stuff people think's gone from the hard drive," said Spanner. "How do you think they keep catching all those pedos?"
"Did you get it back?"
"Yeah, I put it on here."
He handed Strike a memory stick.
"I didn't think you'd want me to put it back on."
"No."
"So the photographs were..."
"Nothing fancy, just deleted.
Like I say, your average punter doesn't realise you've got to work a damn sight harder than pressing delete if you really want to hide something."
17th of March, said Strike.
"Yeah, St. Patrick's Day."
10 weeks after she died.
"Could have been the police," suggested Spanner.
"It wasn't the police," said Strike.
After Spanner had left, he hurried into the outer office and displaced Robin so that he could view the photographs that had been removed from the laptop. He could feel Robin's anticipation as he explained to her what Spanner had done and opened up the file on the memory stick. Robin was afraid, for a fraction of a second, as the first photograph bloomed on screen, that they were about to see something horrible, evidence of criminality or perversion. She had only heard about the concealment of pictures online in the context of dreadful abuse cases. After several minutes, however, Strike voiced her own feelings.
"Just social snaps."
He did not sound as disappointed as Robin felt, and she was a little ashamed of herself. Had she wanted to see something awful? Strike scrolled down through pictures of groups of giggling girls, fellow models, the occasional celebrity. There were several pictures of Lula with Evan Duffield, a few of them clearly taken by one or other of the pair themselves, holding the camera at arm's length, both of them apparently stoned or drunk. Samay made several appearances. Lula looked more formal, more subdued, by his side. There were many of Kiara Porter and Lula hugging in bars, dancing in clubs, and giggling on a sofa in somebody's crowded flat.
"That's Rochelle," said Strike, suddenly pointing to a sullen little face glimpsed under Kiara's armpit in a group shot. Kieran Colovis-Jones had been roped into this picture. He stood at the end, beaming.
"Do me a favour," said Strike, when he had finished trawling through all 212 pictures. "Go through these for me, and try and at least identify the famous people, so we can make a start on finding out who might have wanted the photos off her laptop."
"But there's nothing incriminating here at all," said Robin.
"There must be," said Strike.
He returned to his inner office, where he placed calls to John Bristow, in a meeting and not to be disturbed.
"Please get him to call me as soon as you can."
To Eric Wardle, voicemail.
"I've got a question about Lula Landry's laptop."
And to Rochelle Onofade, on the off chance, no answer, no chance of leaving a message, voicemail full.
"I'm still having no luck with Mr. Bestigui," Robin told Strike, when he emerged from his inner office to find her performing searches related to an unidentified brunette posing with Lula on a beach. "I phoned again this morning, but he just won't call."